Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist, Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. As always, New York State's budget moves towards resolution. Are car dealers ripping off consumers? The state attorney general thinks so, and he's introducing a bill that will make manufacturers more accountable. The Empire State is taking a closer look at its constitution and getting back to the basics of citizen responsibility. We'll have all those stories and political commentary from Fred Dicker of the New York Post. That's coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. When you buy a car, you usually receive a warranty that lasts anywhere from 6 months to 7 years. But what you do not receive is a warranty for any problems that are unique to your model car after the purchase. Bruce Robertson reports on a new bill that will protect consumers from paying unnecessary car repair costs.
Do your car brakes squeal? Is the paint peeling off the body? Maybe you have premature tire wear or a broken timing chain guide. Well, all these problems and many more are products of defects in American and foreign cars, defects that dealers are required to fix at reduced rates or for free, but often do not tell consumers about. New York's Attorney General Robert Abrams has introduced a bill that will protect consumers from what he calls secret warranties. Abrams describes the problem.
Manufacturers very often notify only their dealers when they have established a special adjustment program under which they agree to pay for all or part of specific repairs that are not covered by standard warranties. Consumers who encounter problems endemic to a particular model, such as squealing brakes or leaks or peeling paint or premature tire wear, often remain ignorant of their right to obtain the free or reduced cost of repairs to those particular problems with their automobiles.
The Auto Safety Center, a consumer watchdog group based in Washington, did a survey of American and foreign cars to see how prevalent this secret warranty problem is. The consumer group discovered that millions of Americans have spent in excess of $3 billion in the last decade on repairs that their manufacturers should have paid. In an effort to curtail this problem, Abrams is introducing a bill that requires manufacturers to notify consumers about car troubles and aids consumers who are compelled to sue.
This bill that we are introducing will make it illegal for manufacturers to withhold any information about an established policy to pay for all or part of the cost of a repair beyond the terms of a warranty. The bill would require manufacturers to notify dealers within 30 days and to mail notices to individual owners of cars within 90 days of the adoption of any adjustment program that they have established. It would also require automobile manufacturers to make their service bulletins available to consumers for a reasonable charge and to also maintain hotline numbers, toll-free telephone hotlines to provide consumers with information about the adjustment program. We're trying to put teeth into the program, and so if there's any violation by a manufacturer, the bill provides that a consumer who is obliged to sue to protect his or her rights conveyed under this bill could recover treble damages plus reasonable attorney's fees.
The bill also empowers the Attorney General to bring lawsuits, and it enables judges to impose fines for each violation up to $500. The legislation is sponsored by Republican Senator Paul Kehoe and Democratic Assemblyman Gerald Nadler. Abrams says if the bill passes, it will be the first of its kind in the nation. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
April 1st is the deadline for elected officials to agree on a state budget. Dave Gallutly spoke with Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen about how the discussions were progressing.
I would not describe the budget talks as unpromising. They've just been slower than we anticipated. We honestly felt that there was a very good chance that by Saturday we would have an agreement of principle intent. And then we set a meeting for noon on Sunday when Majority Leader Anderson and Speaker Miller came back to the Capitol fully believing that the staff work would have resolved the basic questions and that there would only be those remaining items that leaders needed to resolve in order to have principal intent and therefore to be able to print the budget and adopt it on time. It has simply taken a lot longer to come to the basic agreements than we had contemplated. We're still optimistic that we can arrive at a handshake agreement, put principal intent on a budget prior to April 1st. It now seems unlikely that the budget could actually be printed up on the desks of the legislatures and passed by the legislature in advance of the April 1st deadline.
What does this mean, basically, to the average person that the state's budget isn't ready by its constitutionally mandated time? What does it mean to the average person?
I don't think it means anything to the average person. We did have a problem with regard to Medicaid payments, and both houses of the legislature have passed, and the governor signed a bill which, in effect, allows us to send out the checks for the Medicaid payments. And I don't think there's any practical effect. It's a theoretical deadline unless it's missed by several weeks, in which case the practical effect is that the state can't pay its bills or meet its payroll.
Senator Anderson has indicated that the Liberty Scholarships Program is perhaps his biggest stumbling point.
Well, I think that he isolated on Liberty Scholarships without really having a full understanding of our problems. We hadn't even gotten the lists from the legislature for the members' items that they wanted to add to the budget at the time he exploded and said that the only impediment to this budget adoption was Liberty Scholarships. Once we received those lists, which was only at the 11th hour, were appalled by the kind of additions to the budget that are being suggested by legislators that bear no relationship to any program that's been established. They just give money away to this institution or that within the state of New York based on some legislators' influence within their leadership. So I've never seen a process like this. Everybody makes fun of the pork coming out of Washington, but I've never seen anything like this. We hadn't even received those lists when Senator Anderson said that the whole problem with the budget was Liberty Scholarships. Certainly we're concerned about Liberty Scholarships. I had a conversation yesterday with Senator Anderson, and I believe we can resolve the Liberty Scholarships. I think we can do what he wants, which is not to wait 5 years to start the program, and do what the governor wants, which is to have a dropout prevention program that starts with youngsters in the seventh grade and says, if you stay in school, we will have scholarships available. These are not mutually exclusive objectives, and I think that through their direct telephone conversations yesterday, Senator Anderson and the governor came to a realization that they are not mutually exclusive. Based on that understanding, I think we'll go forward and negotiate this and other aspects of the budget in the next couple of days, and hopefully before the Passover and Good Friday holidays, religious holidays, we will at least have an agreement so that the state will know that we have a budget that's ready to be adopted.
Okay, so when next week rolls around, do you think we'll have legislative approval?
No question about it. In my mind, I think that the legislature will come in and adopt a budget, and I think it'll be a fiscally responsible budget. We're very concerned that it be limited to what the outside limit of what we should spend, which was the amount recommended by the governor. I think that, the legislature will have changed some of the priorities, which is certainly their policy-making function. And I'm very optimistic that early in the first week of April we'll have legislative adoption of the budget.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. Jesse Jackson is probably one of the most controversial presidential candidates. But it can't be denied he's doing very well compared to the other presidential contenders, with the exception perhaps of Mike Dukakis. But many Jackson supporters are concerned that the Democratic Party will forego a fair nomination process in order to keep Jackson off its ticket. Brenda McMahon has the story.
New York State's April 19th primary is getting closer, and that means Democratic presidential hopeful Jesse Jackson is gearing up his campaign efforts in the Empire State. Jackson is looking to get the largest portion of New York's 255 delegates, hoping to put him in the lead in delegate counts. Over 25 lawmakers gathered together to call for a fair nomination process for the Reverend Jesse Jackson. The black and white senators and assembly members are concerned that Jackson may win more delegates than Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, but because of his race, they fear Jackson will not receive the Democratic nomination. Assemblyman Frank Barbaro is chairman of the Assembly Labor Committee and a Jackson supporter. Barbaro says the nomination process is the soul of democracy and should be treated as such.
I think the issue here really has to be that we're struggling for the soul of the Democratic Party.
That's right.
That's the issue. And the issue is that if Jesse Jackson was white, there would be no question that he would have, no question that he would get the nomination. And I think America has to make a decision. We have a moral test being presented to us. And that is, are we going to accept the racist notion that a black person cannot become the president of the United States?
Assemblyman Arthur Eve says we should not accept that notion. Eve is the upstate coordinator of New Yorkers for Jesse Jackson. He believes the candidate with the most delegates should receive the nomination.
We're absolutely confident that Reverend Jackson will have the largest number of delegates at that time, and therefore he should be the party's nominee. We're confident that he will win New York State, absolutely confident that he will win New York, and that will set the tone for the other states to follow. And so our main word today is that we want the party to support the will of the people. And the candidate who has the largest number of delegates, we're prepared to take our chance because we're confident in the quality of our candidate. And we want the party to give the nomination to the candidate who has the largest number of delegates.
But is there a force trying to stop Jesse Jackson from getting the nomination? Barbaro says he does not think so.
I don't know if there's something alive trying to stop him, but what I do know is when you have a candidate that is speaking to the issues so sharply and clearly as he is, who is posing a threat to the super rich and the power structure in the country, and is about to empower the American people. Well, that's a very, very threatening thing to powerful people. And we're concerned that they will try to thwart the will of the American people. And we're saying that we're a democracy, Jesse is running by the rules, and if he goes in with the largest number, then we should rally around him.
Although Barbaro and other Jackson supporters say they'll back the candidate who receives the greatest number of delegates, even if it's not Jackson, others disagree. Senator Israel Ruiz, a Democrat from the Bronx, says if Jackson does not get the Democratic nomination, he'll encourage others to support the GOP candidate for president.
If anyone is going to derail from the Democratic Party, the Jesse Jackson campaign, I am one, and I only speak for myself, that in November, I will tell my people, let's teach the Democratic Party a lesson, that they can't have it both ways. They can't always be saying, these are our nominees, and you vote for them. When one of our nominees is there, we want him to be supported, and we want him to be pushed. Not to get any extras, but to basically get a fair shake. And I will be willing to tell my people to vote Republican in November if they derail, in any sense, the Jesse Jackson campaign in New York State.
Senator Israel Ruiz. Assemblyman Eve says he hopes Governor Cuomo does not endorse any candidate before the state's April 19th primary, even Jackson. Eve says he hopes Cuomo will accept the will of New Yorkers and campaign for the winner of the state's primary. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brenda McMahon.
As usual, I checked in with Fred Dicker, state editor of the New York Post, for his always scintillating commentary. Fred Dicker of the New York Post, help me figure a few things out here. First of all is the Mario scenario, as we are calling it right now.
Which one?
The Mario scenario leading towards the White House. So,
right.
So pregunta uno is this. Question number one, for those who are not familiar, as we are, with the other language, is this. Who does he like? Does he like Dukakis? Or does he like Jackson? We kept hearing he likes Dukakis. But everything he's doing now would seem to be encouraging a Jackson candidacy. So what's what?
Well, it's complicated. There's no question about it. But there are some tantalizing theories out there. I don't think the question really is who he likes. Who knows who he likes? I mean, presumably he likes himself and his family, but that may be it. What's involved here is what's good for him politically and what he thinks is good for the Democratic Party politically and maybe hopefully for the nation politically. And that's tough to figure out. For a while, there's no question, every indication was he was going towards Mike Dukakis and would probably endorse him. If he endorsed anyone, it was going to be Dukakis. And then came along the Michigan caucuses and a few other things. But the caucuses in Michigan were the decisive factor in leading the governor to conclude that he better not conclude anything for a while. So right now, we have the phenomenon of disarray, not only in the ranks of the New York Democrats, but nationally in the Democratic ranks.
But Freddie, why would he not make a decision based on what he'd heard? Why shouldn't he endorse Dukakis unless it's because, A, he thinks that this thing may end up in a Cuomo draft, or B, he thinks that, in fact, Jackson may win in New York, and therefore he would end up on the wrong end of
Ellen,
the
state? Ellen, he's not impressed with Dukakis. Dukakis is not from the governor's vantage point running an especially impressive campaign, and I think a lot of people agree with that as well. He is impressed with Jackson, and notwithstanding the fact that he disagrees with many of Jackson's positions and things Jackson has done in the past, he gives him credit for what is obviously so far a remarkable campaign. So the governor's attitude is, hey, I don't have to endorse now. Why should I? Let's wait and see what happens. And that's what a lot of other people are saying, too. I mean, there's every indication that Democratic voters are still uncertain who they want their standard bearer to be.
Freddie, could Jackson win in New York State?
Yes, I think Jackson has an excellent chance of winning in New York State in a three-way race.
In other words, as long as Gore is in there and being very active.
Yes, I mean, basically what you have is Jackson with a rock-hard black vote, probably the votes of the left wing of the Democratic Party, able to come up with 42% of the Democratic vote. That leaves 60%. Now, if Dukakis and Gore split that remaining 60%, and every indication is now that they probably will, then Jackson will be the winner by a plurality.
Freddie, I had a big fight with the governor on the Capitol Connection this week. Apparently what he's saying is that the person who goes into the convention with the most votes should be the Democratic nominee. The most delegates should be the Democratic nominee. I tried to argue with him that if
he's tough to argue with, isn't he, sometimes?
Yes, very tough to argue with. If there were two people more like-minded and they combined their vote,
sure,
they might well have a majority,
sure,
and they might well deserve, one of them might well deserve the nomination being more reflective of the Democratic Party. Well, he gave me all his business about, wait a second now, would you like 2,000 people in a smoke-filled room making decisions, or shouldn't the people make the decision? I tried to argue with him, but there was no success in honesty.
Look, I mean, the governor, I think, is not being fully candid about what his motives are in this whole thing. Number one, he's trying to be consistent, and number two, he's trying to avoid any kind of racial polarization in the state, and it's already in New York City, especially a very bad situation race-wise. Now, the reason I say these two things, Alan, is because 3 weeks ago or so, when Dukakis was clearly seen as the front-runner, the governor then endorsed the concept along with Paul Kirk. He really endorsed the call of the National Democratic Chairman, Paul Kirk, that whoever the front-runner was should be given the nomination. Now, if 3 weeks later, when Jackson seems to be doing so well, Cuomo did a flip-flop, reversed his earlier position, he could be accused of doing it only because Jackson is black. And I think in back of the governor's mind was a fear that he'd be attacked on this inconsistency, and perhaps rightly so.
Freddie, moving from things racial, you've been following the Tawana Brawley case. What's
sure.
up?
Well, this coming Monday, one of the three principal characters who have been involved in hindering the investigation of the Brawley case, the Reverend Al Sharpton, is supposed to be leading a march here to, quote, shut down, close quote, the Capitol. Of course, the Capitol is going to be pretty much shut down anyway, since nobody's going to be around. It'll be part of the Easter holiday. But that's really the big news. There have been a couple of reports earlier this week that once again call into question the Brawley story. There was a report that a schoolmate, a classmate of Tawana Brawley a year and a half ago or so, had used, had told a tale similar to Brawley's about a sexual assault, which later turned out not to be so, and that once again raised additional questions about the veracity of the Brawley story. But the investigation seems to be at a stalemate because of the unwillingness of Ms. Brawley and her family to cooperate.
Finally, the Court of Appeals made a little news of its own in the news business this week by setting up a special test in terms of allowing people in civil cases to obtain photographs, notes, materials
sure.
from newspaper people by the subpoena process. And I wonder whether you think that's right. Why should those people have a special protection as opposed to anybody else who happens to be in possession of stuff that may be relevant to a case?
Sure. There are other group categories or classes of people, doctors or clergymen, who have this special category now, along with some journalists. And the reason, of course, is that the state is saying it's in the state's interest, it's in the public interest, to protect journalists under certain circumstances, to encourage them to be able to pursue their business in the interest of the general good of society. But let's keep in mind that you said correctly, Alan, that the ruling involved civil cases. Now, we're not talking about criminal cases here. I think reporters, like any other citizen in a criminal case, has an absolute obligation to cooperate with the authorities to make sure that justice is done.
Well, except even in criminal cases, confidentiality is often shielded, and there's a shield law that shields reporters from reporting.
Now,
what
not
they know.
In New York State.
Mm-hmm.
The New York State shield law only at Section 79H mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. Civil Rights Law only applies to civil cases. The state and federal courts have repeatedly ruled that reporters have no special rights in criminal cases,
mm-hmm.
so I would differ with you on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the Dick Peach case?
The Dick Peach case involved a third party referral on a grand jury finding. It was not specifically involved with criminal activity.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. New York State's ratification of the U.S. Constitution is approaching its 200th anniversary, and celebrations are certainly in store. Paul Rosenthal has more.
Getting back to what the United States Constitution is all about. That's what the New York State Bicentennial Commission has in mind as it starts a program entitled Critical Choices. In keeping with the constitutional idea of popular consent, the commission has set up an essay contest, various town meetings, and a convention in Poughkeepsie. The idea is to follow what was happening in the state 200 years ago as statesmen prepared to ratify the Constitution. Michael Phillips, program director of the Albany-based Bicentennial Commission, explains.
The commission has launched a fairly ambitious program called Critical Choices, which is designed to recreate the phenomenon of popular consent, which is essentially what the ratification of the Constitution was 200 years ago. Right now, 200 years ago, delegate slates were being put together to run for election to the statewide convention, which would be held in Poughkeepsie. What we're doing right now, and the Critical Choices Program is doing, is running a writing or an essay contest which is only 250 words, just a kernel of an idea. And the deadline for that is April 15th. The second aspect to the program are regional town meetings. Now, these will be held at 10 different locations across the state. People are asked to come and address what they feel are the most pressing issues facing them locally. The third aspect of the program is a statewide convention in Poughkeepsie. Delegates are selected from that regional town meeting and from the writing contest, and at the convention in Poughkeepsie, we'll ask them to develop solutions or suggestions, recommendations on what they feel would be the most viable solutions to the problems facing the state.
Phillips says that it is important that people be reminded of the responsibilities they have as citizens and that young people should be involved in the political process.
As a great example of this, the State Social Studies Bureau has mandated a participation in government aspect to the curriculum in our high schools. What this is doing is teaching citizenship in the schools, and if you start students out at 16 or 17, you know, giving them an idea of what their responsibilities are within the system and allowing them an opportunity to develop critical thinking skills, then you're really starting to get to the core of what responsible citizenship is all about.
Phillips says he has received positive feedback thus far concerning the program. He urges anyone interested in the program to call the commission at 518-473-6191. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show is produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Paul Rosenthal, Bruce Robertson, and Dave Galletly. We hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll tune in next week to hear what's happening in and around and above the Empire State. Until then, I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the Legislative Gazette, a weekly newspaper on state politics, with student internships available.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.